From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Later tonight, we go back to Coral Castle in Florida for an incredible story. Here's what's happening. Well, if you have a student loan or you know someone who has a student loan, or perhaps you're a parent helping your child pay off a student loan, the Democratic-sponsored legislation to allow student loan borrowers to refinance at lower interest rates failed to clear a hurdle in the U.S. Senate. Democrats had said their measure would let holders of both federal and private undergrad loans with some rates of 9% or higher to refinance at 3.86%. President Barack Obama signed an executive order making it easier for up to 5 million people to pay off college tuition debt and scolded congressional Republicans for opposing the legislative fix to lower student loan borrowing costs. But right now that plan is dead. Eating a lot of red meat in early adult life may slightly increase the risk of breast cancer, according to a U.S. study. Harvard researchers say replacing red meat with a combination of beans, peas, lentil, poultry, nuts, fish may reduce the risk in younger women. Just take heed on that story. Proposals to extend the use of statin drugs, now those are drugs used to lower cholesterol, should be scrapped, according to a group of leading doctors and academics. The National Institute for Health and Care Excellence published draft guidance calling for their use to be extended to save more lives, but it could mean another 5 million people, for example, in England using them, and there's already 7 million people who already do there. But in a letter to the organization, the experts express concern about the over-medication of healthy people. Iraq seems to be falling apart. For a while, Iraq faded from the collective consciousness, but what happened there just a few days ago should make people sit up and take notice. Extremist militants have overrun the northern city of Mosul, also in Tikrit. And Mosul, of course, is the country's second largest city behind Baghdad. A half a million civilians, 500,000 people, have fled their homes to escape the violence. Iraq is falling apart. Jerome Corsi, of course, who writes for WorldNet Daily, WND, and also noted author's latest book, Hunting Hitler. Jerry, of course, I believe we never should have been in Iraq in the first place, but it is collapsing, isn't it?
No question. Iraq is collapsing fast, and this is a significant development that Mosul has fallen to the radicals. This is a different group than Al-Qaeda. It's a group called ISIS or ASIS. It's a group of Sunni radical terrorists, militants, who want to form a state combining parts of Syria and Iraq, and they're opposed to the Shiite government in Baghdad. And the civil war, which was suppressed by the surge, the U.S. surge in 2008, is now, the surge is over. We've withdrawn from Iraq, and the civil war has taken over, and the Shiite government in Baghdad, I believe, is about to fall.
Now, once it falls, what does that mean to us? What does that mean to our interests? Jerry, of course, one of the main reasons we went into Iraq, of course, was because it is the world's second largest oil reserve country behind Saudi Arabia. What happens?
Well, the country goes into chaos. It descends into civil war between the Sunnis and the Shiites. The Shiites, of course, are also related and allied to Iran, which is Shiite. It's a very complex situation because if you are with this Islamic group seeking to form the state between Iraq and Syria, and you're in Iraq, the United States is opposed to you, but as soon as you go over and fight for the same group in Syria, we're backing that group as opposed to Assad. So we have a complex and very compromised position in the Middle East because of Assad and our opposition to Assad. We're backing the same group that is leading the civil war right now in Iraq. And my guess is that the region just descends into further chaos, and the United States' position in Iraq is going to be, we will have essentially accomplished nothing. And this, I think, also is the future of, in a related way, of Afghanistan with the Taliban resurgent in Afghanistan. We're probably there also going to face a return to Islamic radicalism in Afghanistan, just as we're seeing in Syria right now, in Iraq. The whole region is descending into a very dangerous spread of radical Islam that is really pretty much out of control.
And, of course, what are we doing? There's not much we can do right now, is there?
There's very little we can do. I mean, there's no way we take a massive reentrance of U.S. troops. And, of course, I don't know that we would benefit. We'd probably just complicate the situation and make it even worse, because then everyone would turn against the United States again and fight us while we were there. And we certainly, having been in Iraq since the, you know, George W. Bush decided to go into Iraq after the 9/11 attack, we've really accomplished nothing in over a decade of fighting in Iraq. The Islamic terrorists and radicals are as strong now or stronger than ever. And I think about to take over Iraq and combine with parts of Syria and have a Sunni-Shiite war that expands and probably ultimately involves Iran.
And didn't the Iraqi government also sign a deal with China in terms of pulling out its oil?
Yes, China and the Iraqi government are working on oil. And, of course, Russia's in the middle of this mix as well. And Russia has deep interests right now in probably fostering and continuing this radicalism in the Middle East, because Russia, of course, has its own radical Islamic problem in the southern provinces, the southern states in Russia. So it's, you know, we've got right now a Middle East that is, where you've got the black flag of Al-Qaeda flying in Libya, and you have Al-Qaeda-related black flags now flying throughout Iraq and Syria, and all these countries are descending into chaos.
All right, Jerry, thank you so much. Jerry, of course, you can get his information at WND.com. Toyota recalling 650,000 more cars in Japan over faulty airbags, expanding a recall first announced last year. Right now, their recall is 1.8 million cars all over the planet. A man was arrested by Prescott Valley, Arizona police after he shot his handgun in a residence claimed he was shooting at the moon. The 49-year-old woman who dated him called police because he had fired shots from a handgun. He was still armed at the time when police showed up to take him away. NASA getting ready to launch a flying saucer into Earth's atmosphere to test technology that could be used to land on Mars. If you see this thing flying around, it's a flying saucer. But I wonder where they got the design and the engineering. You know, as we reported earlier, conservative commentator and author Dinesh D'Souza has pleaded guilty to violating federal campaign finance laws. We're going to get Dinesh in the program in just a moment. We're going to talk with him about many of the things that he's been working on. One of his books, America, Imagine a World Without Her. And, of course, he's done a couple documentaries as well. He's next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie. Dinesh D'Souza back with us. Been called one of the top young policymakers in the country by Investors Business Daily. The World Affairs Council lists him as one of the nation's 500 leading authorities on international issues as well. He is with us for a couple hours. A couple of his books, Live After Death and America, Imagine a World Without Her. Dinesh, welcome back so soon, too. We had you on just a little bit for a news item, but it's good to have you for a few hours.
George, it's a pleasure. Good to be on the show.
I don't want to dwell on your guilty plea on the campaign finance law, but if you would like just to give us a little overview of what happened there, because I think that sets the stage for a lot of things that you've been working on. And I got to tell you, I thought you were going to fight this all the way, but tell me what happened.
Well, what happened is a longtime friend of mine named Wendy Long was running for the U.S. Senate in New York. And I've known Wendy for 25 years. We met at Dartmouth College in the early 1980s. And I suggested to her not to run, but she was determined. She was 40 points behind in the polls. It was kind of an impossible campaign. In any event, out of friendship, I tried to help her, and I gave her $20,000 more than the campaign limits allow. The campaign limits allow $10,000 for a couple. And so I convinced two of my friends to give. I reimbursed them. It was a mistake. It was wrong. but it was motivated by a kind of misguided friendship. That's really what happened. I pled guilty to it because I, from the beginning, acknowledged that I had, in fact, exceeded the campaign finance limits, and my fate will be determined by a judge in September.
So when this happened to you, and of course, you know, you pled guilty, you're moving on with your life. As of right now, what's to happen to you?
Well, it's in the hands of a judge, and he has discretion in this sort of a case. Now, there's no corruption involved. Typically, campaign finance laws are intended to prevent people from trying to somehow underhandedly influence a campaign or benefit themselves through some sort of a quid pro quo. None of that is really at issue here. So, you know, the judge is going to have to determine what's fair, and that's all I'm asking. I take responsibility for what I did. I acknowledge what I did was wrong. My issue from the beginning has been that I just don't want to be, in a sense, selectively prosecuted so that the Obama administration is doing to me what it would not normally do, let's say, to one of its own allies who had done the same thing. So here is a guy like Harry Reid, the Senate Majority Leader, and he has been using his campaign funds to fund his relative's wedding. Now, this is kind of outrageous and underhanded, and yet no prosecution, no investigation. So that's why some people have raised the issue of selective prosecution here, because there seems to be a double standard in the overall pattern of how the Obama administration approaches these sorts of issues.
If you were selectively picked and they went after you, you've been doing some things, of course, that weren't too friendly to the administration. Documentaries, books. Let's go through some of those, Dinesh, if you would.
Yes, I wrote a book called The Roots of Obama's Rage in 2010, which kind of exposed the fact that Obama was subscribed to a sort of anti-colonialist ideology that he got from his father. Remember, Obama's own book, his own autobiography, is called Dreams from My Father, in which he describes the way in which his father, although absent from his life, had a kind of decisive influence on his own upbringing. Then I turned that documentary into a movie. I made a film called 2016, which became the second most successful documentary of all time, making $33 million in the theater and then $10 million in DVD. So Obama himself, I know, was deeply upset by this film because he wrote a vituperative attack on it on his personal website, BarackObama.com. And from what I learned about Obama when I was down in Kenya, interviewing his family, his relatives, and so on, is that he's a very vindictive guy. He's the kind of guy who looks at the people who disagree with him not as well-meaning critics, but as enemies who should be, in a sense, ruined. And so we see a pattern in which Obama goes after his critics in that fashion. My partner, Jerry Molin, is a very respected Hollywood figure. He made movies like Jurassic Park and Schindler's List. Mm-hmm. But right after the two of us did 2016, he got a call from the IRS. So they were going after him for, you know, his taxes. Now, they turned out they couldn't get him on anything. But my point is, this is the way these guys operate. So it's in that atmosphere that we're fighting a political battle today. It's a little bit troubling.
Well, there's no doubt about it, especially with what's been going on with the NSA and everything else. It's just, I think, the tip of the iceberg here. Now, you came from India, did you not?
Yes, I was born in Mumbai, you know, Bombay, India, and I came to the United States at the age of 17 as an immigrant. In a way, it's strange because Obama and I have traveled sort of opposite paths. He's born in America, but he has embraced this kind of third world ideology. In my case, I was somebody who was born in the third world, but embraced America and the American way of life.
You love America. There is no question in my mind that you love America deeply. What do you feel these days, Dinesh, in terms of the sentiment toward America?
Well, I think that what I love about America is the great sense of possibility, the American dream, if you will. And what I worry about is that this American dream today has become very precarious. In other words, what's happened today is that we seem to have a leadership in this country that looks upon the forces that built America as oppressive, that says things like capitalism is a form of theft in which entrepreneurs grab from people what Obama calls their fair share. Now, when you really look at what entrepreneurs actually do, this kind of thinking makes no sense. I mean, here's Steve Jobs. He came up with the iPhone. He, in a sense, came up with a product that most of us didn't even know that we wanted or needed, but it became indispensable once he delivered it. Now, who has he been ripping off? Nobody. People willingly stand in line to buy the iPhone. So this whole notion that capitalism is somehow depriving people, Obama says, you know, you didn't build that because you used the public roads and you a public school teacher helped you along somewhere and the police protect you and so on. Well, yeah, but the police protect everybody. Everybody uses the roads. So you can't take away the credit of the entrepreneurs and what they develop by simply making the foolish point that as common citizens, we benefit from the common defense and the common infrastructure that we all pay for.
What is your biggest concern right now as you look at the future of America? What's your concern?
Well, my concern is, you know, countries actually do go up and countries come down. America has been a very special place to live for the past 60 years. It's been a superpower since the end of World War II. It's been the sole superpower since the Soviet Union collapsed in 1992. And during this time, America has had, of course, a wonderful standard of living. Even the ordinary guy, when I first came to America, I was just kind of taken aback at how good the ordinary fellow has it in America. Even the guy that's not that smart or doesn't work that hard has a nice house, has two cars, and lives in a sense a lifestyle that is the envy of much of the world. Also, America has been a country that has had a huge influence in world affairs. Nothing can really happen in Asia or South America or the Middle East without America having at least a powerful say-so. So this is what it means to live in the American era. My great worry is that within this country, we now have a leadership, the so-called progressive movement, if you will, that wants to end American dominance because it believes American dominance is somehow unjust or oppressive. It's not good for America that has only 5% of the world's population to have this outsized standard of living, or it's not good for America to dominate or bully the world from Obama's perspective. So what's really happening is that the people who are taking us down are not Iranian mullahs or Venezuelan dictators or Soviet apparatchiks. They are the people within this country who have essentially lost faith in America.
Are they trying to get us into this one-world government club, Dinesh?
I don't think so. I don't think it's the matter of one world. What Obama wants to do is he wants to make America, I would call it, an ordinary country. And that means an ordinary country like Greece or Finland or Uganda, for that matter. Just one country at the big dining table of nations. And Obama would like to see America go down a bit so that countries like China and Brazil and Russia and India can come up. He thinks the world would be more fair if one country wasn't sitting on the top, but it was what may be called a multipolar world in which there are many different foci of influence. Now, I think what Obama doesn't realize is that that world would actually be far more dangerous. America has actually shown very benign leadership in the world. Right now, ships can go all over the world's oceans because they're protected by the U.S. Navy. The U.S. Navy is protecting the movement of commerce across the oceans. If the U.S. Navy didn't have the dominance it did, then you'd have piracy on the high seas, jostling with China, people torpedoing each other's boats. It would be chaos. So a multipolar world is a far more dangerous world than a world in which a country like America. Now, if America's power was enjoyed by, let's say, China or Russia, they might use it in a different way. But we have used it. I mean, American foreign policy at the core is based on two very simple principles. Number one, don't bomb us. Number two, trade with us. And that's it.
Well, and as you hypothesize America, imagine a world without her. It's not a good world if we're out of the picture, is it?
Well, just look at the 20th century. America basically comes in. It finishes off the Nazis. It defeats the Japanese. And that's impressive enough. But what's more impressive is the United States then proceeds to rebuild those two countries, and former enemies are now friends. Now, other empire would do this.
No.
So there's America, in a sense, has been indispensable in the world. That's why my book is actually called America, Imagine a World Without Her, and I have a movie which is coming out July 2nd nationwide in 1,000 theaters, released by Lionsgate, that explores this very concept. What would the world look like if America ceased to exist?
That will be very successful as well. Now, you also wrote a book about life after death. Let's get into that when we come right back. And welcome back to Coast, Dinesh D'Souza with us. Dinesh, you have such a variety of a background, both in what you do, your movies, your writings. Tell me about how you decided to write a book about life after death.
It was a bit of a departure for me. I mean, most of my career, I've been a political thinker and scholar. I've been a scholar at Stanford University, at the Hoover Institution, earlier at the American Enterprise Institute in Washington, D.C., and of my 13 books, 10 of them are about politics. And in some ways, I think it's fair to say that they're about America. I've written about education, a book called Illiberal Education, a book about civil rights, a book about capitalism. But America has been the big political topic for me. A few years ago, I turned on the television to see the famed atheist, now the late Christopher Hitchens, debating a pastor from Alabama and making him look, you know, ridiculous. Kind of scorning him and ridiculing him and so on. And several years earlier, I had debated Hitchens about capitalism versus socialism, and I think I whipped him so badly that at the end of the debate, he came to me and he said, "I will never call myself a socialist again." So I thought, wow, you know what? I wonder if I should climb into the ring with Hitchens and take him on this atheism stuff, because it was remarkable to see these new atheists, from the biologist Richard Dawkins to Hitchens, the philosopher Daniel Dennett, many of these others, kind of making statements about God and about life after death, about which they knew absolutely nothing. So they were proclaiming as fact things that they, for which they had absolutely zero evidence. So I thought it would be kind of comical almost to get into the ring, not to basically assert that there is life after death, but basically to defend the idea that life is a mystery. You know, here we are flung into the world. We don't know why we're here. We don't know what's going to come after we die. We don't know the purpose of our existence. So to go around pontificating, there's no God, there's no life after death, these are people making assertions about things that they have absolutely no basis for what they're saying.
So when you decided to jump into this, and was your background, were you raised a Hindu?
Well, I was raised a Christian in a Hindu world. In other words, my ancestors were Hindu, but they converted to Christianity as a result of the activities of Portuguese missionaries in a small part of India called Goa. This happened in the 17th and 18th centuries, so it went back a couple of hundred years. So I grew up Christian, but very, you know, I wasn't devout. I was kind of a social Christian, and I was surrounded by Hindus and Muslims. Of course, one of the remarkable things about life after death is all these different religions, which developed in many cases separately. Now, Islam, of course, in the Abrahamic tradition, with Judaism and Christianity, but then the Eastern religions, all of them independently affirming that there's some sort of transcendent existence above and beyond this world. So I find it fascinating, and I've studied the topic, not so much as a theologian, but more as a scholar, a historian. So when I debate these guys, I don't use the Bible. I don't invoke scripture or authority. I appeal to the same history and philosophy and science that they do.
And isn't it interesting that all these religions, all of them, all believe in the same God?
They believe in the same God. They sometimes use different terms and names, and their theological explanations are different. I mean, the Hindus have this remarkable idea that the life that we live now is kind of an illusion. It's a projection of another world, so to speak, where everything is one. Everyone is connected to each other and connected to God. So this is a startling philosophical kind of claim. And it should be taken seriously. But what I find about these atheists is that they're so glib. They're so convinced that matter is all there is, whereas all we have to do is look within ourselves to see that matter is not all there is. You have something like a thought, an emotion. Now, no one can deny that in order to have emotions, you need to have senses. But to say that your thoughts and emotions, which have no mass, no weight, don't have physical properties, are nothing more than a projection of, you know, the physical molecules that make up your body, this is at best a contentious and controversial position that needs to be argued out. It can't just be assumed.
But the fact that an atheist does not believe, you don't knock that, because that's their view, right?
Well, you know, I remember a debate I had with the skeptic Michael Shermer, who's a friend of mine and the editor of Skeptic Mag. So Shermer goes, "Dinesh, you Christians are so irrational because you believe that there's life after death. And he goes, wait a minute. Have you been to the other side of the curtain? Have you interviewed any dead people? No. So you can't possibly know that there's life after death. So your position is completely irrational. So I said, Michael, let me ask you a question. Do you believe there's life after death? He goes, of course not. So I go, oh, have you been to the other side of the curtain? Have you interviewed any dead guys? No. So you don't have any more information than I do. Your position that there's no life after death, just like my position that there is based on faith. The difference between you and me is not that you know more and I know less. The real difference is I'm at least willing to acknowledge that mine is a faith-based position. You, poor atheist, have deluded yourself into believing that your position is somehow based on evidence for which you have none.
We had Michael Shermer here, and we did a debate with him years ago, and he was trounced by one of our ufologists, you know, and, you know, the coast-to-coast listenership, but Dennis, they had the opportunity to vote, and, you know, people are generally, they want to be believers, and I would guess if you went out and polled people, most people would believe that there is life after death, don't you think?
Absolutely. I think that they would. In fact, if you conducted a poll in the West, I think you'd get a majority. But if you conducted a poll worldwide, you'd get 85% or more. Now, look, this isn't just a matter of, you know, superstition or cultural practice. The fact of the matter is that science itself is showing us that the world that we thought we knew is vastly more complicated and vastly more mysterious than we know. Bertrand Russell, the great mathematician, once poo-pooed or ridiculed the idea of life after death. He said, you know, it's just absurd because we know the properties of matter. We know that matter disintegrates. We know that the body dissolves. So the very concept of life after death, he says, is just beyond belief. Now, the problem with all that is that now, after Russell's day, we realize that when we, with all these new discoveries about dark matter and dark energy and so on, that we actually only know the properties of a tiny portion of the matter in the universe, some 4%. 95% of the matter and energy in the world is completely mysterious. We don't know anything about its properties whatsoever. So once again, to go around arrogantly proclaiming that this cannot be, when we know that science is constantly showing that things that we previously thought couldn't be can in fact be, is pure dogmatism.
Is your door open to the possibility that you might be wrong about life after death?
Absolutely. One of the topics I like to speculate about and think about is what is called Pascal's wager. Pascal basically says that either there's life after death or there isn't. In either case, you could be wrong. So you got to weigh the possibility. It's like an investment, right? You're making an investment you could gain, but you could lose. You got to weigh the odds. And so I'm completely open to the possibility that the beliefs that I have might be mistaken. And my argument in my book, which is called, by the way, not Live After Death, but Life After Death, the evidence, is simply that the weight of the evidence is on my side. Not that I have a proof, but that when you balance the two, the weight of the evidence is on the side that there is life after death.
Well, it is somewhat skewed one-sided, though, and that is, if there is life after death, you will know it. If there isn't, you won't. So it really doesn't matter, does it?
No, I think that's absolutely right. In that sense, it's a verifiable proposition, although it's going to be a while before we'll know for sure.
You wrote a book earlier about education, one of your first works, and I wanted to get your reaction to this student loan debacle here where, you know, the Democrats really want to get these interest rates lowered, and it appears that the Republicans seem to be fighting that. What's your reaction to that?
Well, I think the thing with Obama that he tries to do is he always tries to offer something for free, in the hope that it will get people to his side, even though they've done nothing to actually earn it. You know, so he'll go over to immigrants or he'll go over to people in Mexico and say, listen, bring your kids to the border so that they can't turn them away. And then come to America where we have all kinds of free stuff waiting for you. Or he'll basically say to the guy who's, you know, down on his luck, he'll say, look at that guy in there, you know, sitting in the restaurant and look at him laughing. You know, how come he's eating a $30 steak and you can't order one? In other words, what's going on here is that what the Democrats are doing is they're spending money that's not theirs. They're, in a sense, robbing Peter to pay Paul and counting on Paul to be enthusiastically supportive. And this is the politics that Obama learned, in a sense, at the feet of Saul Alinsky. Saul Alinsky wrote the book Rules for Radicals in the 1960s. And Alinsky was very blunt. Alinsky's point was you have to stir up envy, hatred, resentment, and malevolence in a society. You have to be willing to lie to achieve your goals. And it seems that Obama has taken these lessons to heart.
Okay, but lowering interest rates for people who have a difficult time paying, not a bad idea.
Not a bad idea. But look, being able to go to my local grocery store and get food for free, also not a bad idea. In other words, in any society, it's always a good idea to be able to get free stuff or to pay less. Interest rates, by and large, are set by the market. And interest rates really right now are quite low because the Federal Reserve has been pumping hundreds of billions of dollars into the economy. So it's not like we're dealing with the interest rates of the 1970s. The problem with Obama is not that he's lowering interest rates. The problem is that all these young people who are graduating from college, even very good colleges, can't find a job. He should really focus his attention on that, because sometimes when I see these young people and they're like, I can't find a job, I'm like, look, I don't know if you should blame Obama or you should blame yourself for voting for that guy.
So we remain very nonpartisan on this program, Dinesh. As you know, you've been on my show many, many, many times. I've got to ask you point blank. Do you like President Obama as a person? I don't think you do.
Well, I want to be careful here, because there are people who have, in a sense, they look at Obama like, oh, he's such a bungler. You know, he's so incompetent. He can't read the teleprompter. This is not my view of Obama. I actually think Obama, what I find particularly weird about Obama is he is an American success story. He is a very unlikely person to have the kind of success he does, and only in America is his story possible. That makes what he's doing, from my point of view, even more scandalous. I also must say I admire Obama. He said he wanted to remake America, and he's doing it. In that sense, he's a bit like Reagan. If I can make a nonpartisan point, Reagan changed America, and Obama's changing America in another direction. So I don't have any personal grudge against the man. I don't think he's a bad guy. I admire his family life. I admire his personal discipline, and I admire the determined way that he goes about achieving his objectives.
You do not? I haven't heard you say the president yet. How come?
Well, I'm happy to say it right now. President Obama, we elected him. we, the American people, chose him.
I had to squeeze it out of you, didn't I?
No. It may be an excessive familiarity because I've been writing about him now uninterruptedly for 3 years. But no, he's our president, and I acknowledge that.
Well, another poll came out today, and his popularity seems to be waning again. It's going down. It had a little spike a few weeks ago, but it's going back down now to real low numbers. So it's got to be pretty difficult. I mean, here's a person who came just out of nowhere and remarkably got elected president as people just opened their arms for him. Do you think generally, without us being too political here, that people are just not happy with the way government is running things right now? I think they're very unhappy.
No, I think that is absolutely true. I mean, whatever the government does, we have to say it does badly. And I say this in a truly nonpartisan way. I mean, when the Defense Department spends $300 on a coffee pot, that is just as the same incompetence one sees in the Department of Education or the DMV. So the government can be counted on to do things in a more expensive, incompetent, irresponsible, and unprofitable way than the private sector. You don't have the same level of innovation. Look, Steve Jobs built the iPhone. Obama can't put up a website. There's a huge difference here of capability, and Obama has almost infinite resources available to him. So government is not Obama's fault. Government does this stuff badly because there's no bottom line. It's simply impossible for a group of people in Washington, in a centralized fashion, to have information about what's going on all over this vast and complex economy. So I have some sympathy for the bureaucrats who try to run things from the center and can't. Whether it's a Republican or a Democrat doing that, it's very difficult for the government to do effectively.
My psychics have predicted that in 2016 it will be Hillary Clinton versus Jeb Bush. What do you think of that prediction?
I think that that's a real possibility. I think that Hillary would be a very difficult candidate to beat, partly because of, like Obama, she has sort of a historic claim, the first woman president, as a real possibility. I also am dismayed at the way the Republican Party has been so inept, really, since the Reagan years. So I think it's going to be a very tough and hard-fought election.
Yeah, there's no question about that. Now, of all the books you've written, 13 of them to date, which is your favorite?
Well, the new book is very close to my heart because as I say, my books have been in obliquely approaching the topic of America from different directions. But in the new book, which is just called America, Imagine a World Without Her, I sort of pulled the threads together and I asked a startling question, which is, you know, what if there never was an America? Now, you know, one way then there could never be an America, it would be have an asteroid hit the continent and vaporized America and the landmass of America went away. But another way would be if a sniper shot George Washington and down he went, and then there would be America, the landmass, yes, but there'd be no American Revolution, there'd be no Constitution. This America that we have now would not exist. If Hitler got the atomic bomb first, he would have dropped it. No America. So, and the reason I'm doing all this is I'm sort of actually looking to the future and saying, look, what would the future look like if America begins to shrink or lessen in importance?
I want to ask you about 9/11, about that tragedy that occurred so many years ago now that still remains on the minds of so many people. There are those who believe that there was some in government who actually plotted it, planned it, did it. There are others that say nonsense, total ridiculous. There are others who say, how did Building 7 fall when it was never really hit by anything? What's your overall take on what happened on that day?
My overall take is that 9/11 was done by a group of very pious Muslims, radical Muslims, if you will, who had initially begun a fight against what they called the near enemy. Now, the near enemy was their own government in places like Egypt and Saudi Arabia. And, of course, they also fought what they called the little Satan, which was Israel. But some of them decided, bin Laden foremost among them, that it's time to go after the great Satan, the far enemy. And the far enemy is the United States. They had seen the Soviet Union collapse. In fact, some of them had fought as Mujahideen against the Soviet Union. They were surprised by the brittleness and the ease with which that great empire just essentially dissolved. And so they thought, look, yeah, here's the next one, America. If we give them a shock blow to the solar plexus, maybe they'll crumble too. And so I think 9/11 was a new kind of war launched by a new kind of pious warrior, motivated, if you will, by Islamic devotion and fanaticism. So since then, I think, you know, it's quite remarkable how we don't want to say the word Muslim. We don't want to say the word terrorist. The Obama administration's been very careful trying not to do those things. And it's difficult for me to understand events when you start erasing the motivations of an accurate description of who did these things and why.
Dinesh, when we come back, final hour with you, we're going to take phone calls on all these subjects. Next on Coast to Coast AM.